Felstina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Woronoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, opposition grows to pipeline expansion plans in the Pacific Northwest. A big victory handed to Native families from the U.S. Supreme Court. And from opioids to starving college students, Oregon's members of Congress face voters with some of their top concerns. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 15th, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. A major expansion for a gas pipeline in the Pacific Northwest is getting pushback in the region. The federal government could decide as soon as next month on whether to increase the pipeline's flow by 150 million cubic feet per day. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
The potential expansion of a fracked gas pipeline in the Northwest faces growing resistance as a decision from the federal government nears. The Gas Transmission Northwest, or GTN pipeline, moves fracked gas from Canada to California. The Canadian company TC Energy's proposed GTN Express would expand the pipeline dramatically. The company is waiting for approval from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper says attorneys general from California, Oregon, and Washington have sent a letter urging the agency to deny the proposal.
The states are arguing to FERC that, one, there's no demand for GTN Express. Two, GTN Express directly conflicts with the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals. And three, there are negative impacts from this project to communities along the pipeline route.
If approved, he says, the emissions created by the expanded pipeline would be equivalent to adding 754,000 cars to the road every year. Gas Transmission Northwest says the project is necessary to provide a reliable source of fuel to the region. FERC could make a decision on the expansion proposal as soon as July 27th. The pipeline runs across eastern and southeast Washington and through central Oregon. Sears says FERC has been talking about environmental justice and listening to communities when they raise concerns about energy projects. He says they have an opportunity with this proposal to follow through on that promise.
It's incumbent on the Biden administration to walk the talk, to actually follow through and translate what they're saying about environmental justice and the voices of communities into their decision making.
Sears notes Washington Utility and Transportation Commission members were skeptical of the necessity of the project at a meeting in early June. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Too many college students are going hungry, according to Oregon Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici. The Democrat highlighted that and other priorities in a telephone town hall. Here's part of what she said.
Child care and early childhood education, very important investments for our children, our families, and the economy, and also affordable higher education, whether that be college or another path, for example, in the trades to a good job. On hunger, we have anti-hunger programs like SNAP, which used to be called food stamps. In the United States, there's no reason why anyone should go hungry, but we still have too much food insecurity. We need to reduce the stigma around that. People oftentimes are just in a challenging time in their life. I actually used food assistance when I was in college because I was working my way through, and I wouldn't have had enough to eat without it. And when I worked at Legal Aid, when I was a college student and law student, I helped families who were struggling, not by their choice, but because of circumstances. And these programs help. So SNAP is an effective anti-hunger program, and I've been working on increasing access. In fact, early this Congress, I introduced the Opportunity to Address College Hunger Act based on conversations with students and educators, because I learned how much food insecurity there is on college campuses. This will help students. The Senior Hunger Prevention Act I also have introduced, and that's going to make it easier for older adults, grandparent caregivers, adults with disabilities to access SNAP benefits. And just last week, I introduced the Support for SNAP Act to help people experiencing homelessness access benefits. If we're needing and wanting to get people off the street and into a path to a job and a home, we need to make sure they're not hungry. So those are a few of the issues in hunger and food insecurity I'm working on, as well as the school nutrition program. Housing is an issue that comes up across Northwest Oregon, not just in the urban areas, but in the suburban and rural areas as well. Simply put, we need more housing, and we desperately need more affordable housing. Rents are going up, housing costs are going up higher, faster than wages, and it's been too hard for people to keep up. We need more affordable housing. And then on climate, Natalie mentioned in that introduction that I served on the Select Committee on the Climate Crisis. Addressing climate change is an economic issue, it's a public health issue, it's a national security issue. So as we transition to clean energy, that means jobs and a healthier community and healthier state and healthier planet. I do a lot of work on ocean health as well. In fact, we just had a great briefing today in the Bipartisan Ocean Caucus about the health of the ocean. So, a casework. This is an important part of what we do in the office. My office can, which is in Beaverton, we can help constituents anywhere in the 1st District, which is all of Tillamook County, Clatsop County, Columbia County, and part of Washington County, part of Multnomah County. We can help constituents who are having trouble with a federal agency, whether it be Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, immigration. I was just able to help a constituent get military medals that her father had earned in World War II. Things like that really make a difference, and it's our honor to help. So if you have casework or something you'd like to talk with my staff about, please call my Oregon office at 503-469-6010. Or you can submit your request through my website, which is Bonamici, B-O-N-A-M-I-C-I, .house.gov. And again, the phone number is 503-469-6010.
That's Oregon Democratic Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici. And the opioid epidemic in Oregon is a top priority for Republican Congresswoman Lori Chavez-DeRemer. Here's how she explains some of her top issues in her recent telephone town hall.
A very important issue, tackling the fentanyl crisis. First, I want to start by talking about this issue that has been devastating to our communities. The fentanyl crisis has hit Oregon even worse than most states. In fact, teenagers in Oregon are dying from drug overdoses at a faster rate than any other state. Adolescent overdose deaths have more than tripled in Oregon since 2019, and CDC data shows this crisis has been caused by fentanyl and fentanyl-laced pills. I'm working on several pieces of legislation that enact tough penalties to deter fentanyl trafficking, including legislation that passed the House 2 weeks ago, the bipartisan Halt Fentanyl Act, which would classify any illicit drugs containing fentanyl as a Schedule I drug. I also recently helped introduce the bipartisan Fend Off Fentanyl Act, which strengthens current penalties to target the cartels and criminals around the world who are involved in the trafficking of this deadly drug. A consequence of widespread substance abuse is that it creates a spiral of addiction, which can often lead to poverty and homelessness. Tackling that homelessness crisis is also very important. Oregon's recent growth in homelessness is among the largest in the nation. It's clear that continuing to throw money at the problem isn't working, so I'm working to explore other options. I'm working on some legislation to address homelessness, which I hope to announce in the next month or two. My proposal would help provide homeless individuals with needed care so that they can transition off the streets and into safe and stable housing. It would specifically provide dual diagnosis care, helping to treat individuals who both have mental health disorder and a substance abuse disorder, which is more prevalent among the homeless. Separately, I'm also working on legislation called the HOME Act that seeks to help homeless veterans get the care and resources they need. My legislation, which has the support of House Veterans Committee Chairman, would increase funding assistance for organizations that partner with the VA to provide transitional housing to homeless veterans, such as the Salvation Army. It would also create a stipend for homeless veterans to use and purchase necessities, including food, clothing, blankets, and hygiene products. The stipend could also be used to purchase a cell phone so that they can keep in touch with family members, healthcare providers, and prospective landlords. I'm looking forward to officially introducing this bill on Thursday. Now, most of you all know Economy and Fiscal Responsibility Act. There's been plenty of questions regarding my vote to raise the debt ceiling. I voted for the Bipartisan Fiscal Responsibility Act because it was common sense, bipartisan solution to America's debt crisis. Just like the House's previous debt proposal, this bill protected Social Security, Medicare, veterans programs, and national defense priorities. The Fiscal Responsibility Act will prevent inflation from getting worse by limiting future spending growth, rescinding $29 billion in unobligated and unspent COVID funds, and implementing permitting changes that would also streamline construction projects and create good-paying union jobs in Oregon. At the end of the day, I know Oregonians want to see less partisanship coming out of D.C., not more. You want leaders to find common ground, and I commend President Biden and Speaker McCarthy for coming to the table and getting this done for the American people. The nature of divided government is that not everyone gets everything that they want, and that is certainly true about this piece of legislation. But it's a pragmatic proposal that brought both sides to the table and stopped the U.S. from defaulting on our debt, all while saving taxpayers $2.1 trillion over 6 years. I was proud to support it and will continue working to make sure Washington is spending responsibly.
That's Oregon Republican Congresswoman Lori Chavez-Dreamer. Starbucks lost a multi-million-dollar lawsuit related to firing an employee after a racially charged incident in 2018. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
A federal court has awarded $25.6 million to a former Starbucks regional manager who alleged that she and other white employees were unfairly punished following the arrest of two black men at a Philadelphia location in 2018. Shannon Phillips won $600,000 in compensatory damages and $25 million in punitive damages after a jury in New Jersey found that race was a determinative factor in Phillips' firing, violating federal and state anti-discrimination rules. In April of 2018, a Philadelphia store manager called police regarding two black men who were sitting in the coffee shop without ordering. Phillips, then regional manager of operations in the area, was not involved with the arrests. However, she said she was ordered to put a white manager, who also wasn't involved, on administrative leave for reasons she knew were false. She was fired less than a month later after objecting to the manager being placed on leave. The company's rationale for suspending the district manager, who was not responsible for the store where the arrest took place, was an allegation that black store managers were being paid less than white managers. Phillips said that argument made no sense, since district managers had no input on employees' salaries. The lawsuit alleged Starbucks was instead taking steps to punish white employees who worked in the area, quote, in an effort to convince the community that it had properly responded to the incident, end quote. During closing arguments, Phillips' lawyer told jurors that the company was looking for a sacrificial lamb. Starbucks denied Phillips' allegations, saying the company needed someone with a track record of strength and resolution during a crisis, and that it replaced her with a regional manager who had such experience. However, earlier testimony from a black district manager who was responsible for the store where the arrest took place described Phillips as someone beloved by her peers and as a very diligent worker. In the April 2018 incident, the two men refused to either make a purchase or leave the premises. They were later released without charges. Video of the arrest prompted national outcries and led the current CEO of Starbucks to personally apologize to the men. The company later reached a settlement with both of them for an undisclosed sum and an offer of free college education. The company also changed store policies and closed locations across the country for an afternoon for racial bias training. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A young member of Oregon's wolf pack was killed earlier this week, marking a serious blow to the recovery of the species in the state. The Center for Biological Diversity reports that the female wolf, identified as OR-143, was struck and killed by a vehicle along Highway 138. She was a member of the Indigo Pack, one of very few wolf families currently living in western Oregon. Researchers following wolf recovery in the region say this particular animal was not avoiding humans like wolves typically do, leading them to suspect that people had fed her from cars. Amarik Weiss, a senior wolf advocate for the Center for Biological Diversity, says, quote, being struck by a car is almost inevitable when people feed wild animals, because those animals lose their fear of both vehicles and their human occupants. According to the most recent count from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, the state's currently home to about 178 wolves living in 24 packs. Social isolation is a pervasive health problem for all Americans, and particularly for older people. Organizers of a volunteer fair in Southern Oregon say getting involved in the community can help both the seniors and the volunteer organizations recover from pandemic losses.
A volunteer fair is encouraging older Oregonians to get involved in their communities and fight the social isolation that became pervasive during the pandemic. The Community Volunteer Fair takes place in Medford on June 23rd. Cassie Rose is head of the Community Volunteer Network, which is hosting the event for folks age 55 and older.
Volunteer recruitment is a big need in our community. Our community took a big hit after COVID, and we're trying to rebuild the volunteer database to get more people involved, and we're excited to feature over 20 programs.
Rose says organizations in the region are able to provide services to people because of the work of volunteers. United States Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy has raised the alarms about loneliness as a public health crisis in the country. Murthy notes that even before the pandemic, about half of U.S. adults reported measurable levels of loneliness. Rose says volunteering is a solution for overcoming feelings of isolation.
Lacking social connection is as dangerous as smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day. Getting involved in the community through volunteerism is a way to combat that.
The volunteer fair takes place from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. in downtown Medford. It's a free event and only for people age 55 and older. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, clouds roll in, a low down to 53. Tomorrow's weather, clouds continue, up to 77. Today in history, on this date in 1776, the state of Delaware declared itself independent of British rule. Our quote of the day is from President Joe Biden, who represented Delaware in the U.S. Senate. Failure at some point in your life is inevitable, but giving up is unforgivable. The chief of Cherokee Nation and many others are celebrating a U.S. Supreme Court decision supporting a law that favors keeping Native children with Native families. It was a 7-2 ruling. With that story and more, here's today's National Native News.
The principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, Chuck Hoskin Jr., celebrated the U.S. Supreme Court's decision Thursday to uphold the Indian Child Welfare Act.
It's a wonderful day for Indian country, and it's a wonderful day for anyone in the country that cares about the rights of Native children.
The decades-old law is intended to keep Native children with Native families. Some states and individuals were fighting to overturn ICWA, claiming it's unconstitutional. Hoskin says Indian country was on edge, concerned about losing on any number of grounds, including on equal protection. He says it's one of the most important parts of the case, the bedrock principle of Indian law that tribes are sovereign.
The equal protection attack was to suggest that ICWA was really a race-based preference. In addition to that being a potential fatal blow to ICWA, it could have put in doubt a large number of statutes and even previous decisions that stand for the proposition that citizens of Indian nations hold a different status, that it's not a racial classification, that the preferences and benefits afforded to tribes and their citizens are really part of respecting tribal sovereignty and again, in some measure, to achieve some justice for a group of people in this country that, as we all know, have suffered greatly.
Hoskin says now that the case is decided, he hopes Indian country can move forward to focus on what's best for children. He says Cherokee Nation will continue to devote resources to child welfare, but also says this case shows Indian country is ready for any future challenge.
We also know that, you know, another attack could be around the corner, whether it's in the Congress or whether it's in the courts. We will be ready, and I think the country knows that we're not just going to be pushed over on these cases.
Tribes across the country and Native organizations were among those to advocate for the Indian Child Welfare Act. In a statement, the National Congress of American Indians said it's overcome with joy that the Supreme Court has upheld the Indian Child Welfare Act, which is widely regarded as the gold standard of child welfare. The statement went on to say to fully understand the implications of the decision, they're conducting a thorough legal review and will later provide in-depth analysis, and that ICWA is crucial for the safety and well-being of Native children and Native families and the future of Native peoples and tribal nations. NCAI called it a positive impact that will be felt across generations. U.S. Senator Brian Schatz, chairman of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, applauded the decision. In a statement, he said the Supreme Court just validated what Indian country and tribal advocates have been saying for generations. The Indian Child Welfare Act is the gold standard of child welfare policy. 87 members of Congress had advocated for ICWA in the case. A new law aims to silence a controversial siren in western Nevada. It's part of the region's painful legacy of sundown towns. KUNR's Maria Palma reports.
In 1921, the town of Minden began sounding an evening siren, warning indigenous people it was time to leave the city limits or face violent consequences. For citizens of the Washoe Nation, the sound carries painful memories. Until 1974, anyone who wasn't white had to leave Minden in neighboring Gardnerville at the end of every day. Some Minden residents insist the siren is simply meant as a tribute to first responders. But a new state law says sirens can only be sounded for an emergency and a couple other exceptions. Counties could be fined up to $50,000 for every violation, meaning Minden would have to pay $100,000 per day for the two times the siren now sounds. I'm Maria Palma.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
In a smoky summer, outdoor workers can't overlook heat threats. A federal agency is trying to get the message to anyone working outdoors that they need to protect themselves from extreme heat. Mike Moen has more on the story.
Periodic smoky air from Canadian wildfires is getting attention over public health concerns. But those who work outdoors in South Dakota and elsewhere urge not to forget another safety message as summer ramps up. Heat illness prevention. June is National Safety Month, and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration says employers are required to protect workers from heat-related hazards. Sheila Stanley, a regional OSHA director in Sioux Falls, says companies need to develop plans that center around educating workers about the warning signs.
Employees must be trained on symptoms that they need to look out for in themselves, including dizziness, headache, confusion.
Extra water and break time in the shade are other important reminders. Stanley says beyond education, companies need to find ways to ensure a worker's body becomes acclimated to rising temperatures. In the latest data available, the Bureau of Labor Statistics says there were 36 work-related deaths tied to heat exposure in 2021, the lowest number since 2017. Stanley says with noticeable turnover in job fields that involve outdoor projects, it's especially important to help new hires who don't have experience working in extreme heat. And with more projects carried out under the federal infrastructure law, advanced planning is key.
Employers must incorporate into their budget engineering controls such as cool air-conditioned cabs when it's very hot, reflective clothing when appropriate, that they take the protective measures into account when they bid for these new jobs that are coming down the pike.
OSHA also has an app that allows workers and supervisors to calculate the heat index for their job sites. The online tool is available in English and Spanish for Android and iPhone devices. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, each year there are an average of 702 heat-related deaths in the U.S. More than 9,200 land in hospitals and 67,000 end up in emergency rooms due to heat. Higher temperatures are also linked to heart disease-related deaths, as Deborah Van Fleet reports.
With summer heat already here, the American Heart Association wants people to remember that extreme temperatures can put extra stress on the heart and increase the risk of death. This was the conclusion of an international study of over 32 million cardiovascular deaths over a 40-year period, published last year in the Heart Association's journal Circulation. Dr. Peter Panagas at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis says the increased risk is most notable for people with cardiovascular disease.
And that would be ischemic heart disease due to narrowing of the arteries, stroke, heart failure, or arrhythmias or abnormal heart rate.
Panagas says simple steps can help prevent heat-related illness. Avoid being outdoors during the hottest time of the day, between noon and 3 p.m. Wear lightweight, light-colored clothing, a hat, and sunglasses. Stay hydrated and apply sunscreen frequently. He recommends taking breaks from the sun and cooling down with fluids and water if experiencing lightheadedness, cramps, or other symptoms of overheating. He adds, never leave children or pets in a parked car on hot days. The human body is well adapted for temperature regulation in hot conditions, Panagas says, but less so in infants, young children, and adults over 65. And he notes some widely used medications can interfere with this regulatory process.
Those who are physically ill, especially individuals with heart disease, high blood pressure, who take certain medications which are very common, such as medications for depression, insomnia, or the inability to sleep, or for general conditions of poor circulation.
Panagas explains that heat-related illnesses exist on a spectrum, from sunburn and heat cramps to heat exhaustion and, worst of all, heat stroke.
And that's a sudden and progressively increased high body temperature, hot, red, or dry, damp skin, very fast, strong pulse, headache, dizziness, nausea, vomiting, and most importantly, passing out or loss of consciousness.
He cautions that heat stroke, while rare, is very serious and can be fatal. I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
Some Oregon voters in 12 conservative rural counties claim they want to be part of Idaho. That's one of the stories making news in rural America.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. Majorities in 12 rural eastern Oregon counties would rather live in Idaho, one of the most conservative states. A vote to secede just barely passed in agriculturally dependent Wallula County. Oregon native Rosalind Mock says Spokesfield Democratic lawmakers in the state capital, 400 miles away, don't understand their concerns.
There's been some work where we, quote-unquote, engage with rural communities, but really we want a seat at the table.
Mock has moved back to Oregon after earning a master's in public policy. She says reviving the Office of Rural Policy, a victim of the Great Recession, could help bridge the divide.
It would increase rural capacity and improve the way our communities work with state and local government, while also rebuilding trust in our state government.
A vote to secede would need approval from both states and Congress. Start with fresh air and less traffic. Toss in biking, hiking, and access to water, and more people are moving to the northern Great Lakes. The far-flung parts of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota had more growth last year than the rest of rural America. Daily Yonder writer Sarah Malott speculates that since the pandemic, urban remote workers are seeking greener spaces.
People who could afford to choose where to live are probably going to choose a really beautiful location with lots of amenities.
In 2020 and 2021, the U.S. population grew at its lowest rate since 1900, and half of all counties lost people or stayed flat. But in Michigan, most counties grew, Malott says it may also be due to faster internet access if the trend continues.
Rural counties in the region would grow by another 1.5 million residents by the next decade.
A rural Virginia county is joining other communities in honoring victims of racial injustice. Anya Slepian explains.
A coalition of citizens in Wise County has partnered with the nonprofit Equal Justice Initiative to erect memorials to victims of lynchings. The coalition's Preston Mitchell says they want to move the community forward by shining a light on some of America's darker moments.
This necessary conversation, this honest conversation, just telling of the truth, is really the only way that that wound's going to heal.
Over 4,000 African Americans were lynched between the end of the Civil War and World War II. Sia Sane, with the Equal Justice Initiative, says folks have put up 75 monuments commemorating victims of racial terror in the past 8 years.
We were really interested in bringing the history to life by connecting with communities.
I'm Anya Slepian.
America's newest federal holiday, Juneteenth, celebrates June 19th, when the last enslaved people in Texas learned they were free in 1865.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 15th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Michelle Coppola, Eric Tagadoff, Mike Moen, and Deborah Van Fleet. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for tuning in. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.